Sick of procurement bottlenecks, endless back and forth, and last-minute surprises? Get the cure with Bill Procurement. Bill is the all-in-one platform trusted by nearly 500,000 businesses to simplify and automate their financial operations. And now they've introduced Bill Procurement, which pairs seamlessly with accounts payable to automate procure-to-pay workflows in one place. Every step, from submitting a purchase request to reconciling payment, happens in Bill Procurement. You'll know whether spend is approved before you buy, and Bill's AI-powered automation helps reduce errors so you can make purchasing decisions with confidence. Plus, Bill Procurement puts everything you need to match and pay invoices right at your fingertips. So dump your clunky procurement process and keep your business moving and growing with Bill Procurement. Purchase, pay, and on with your day. Right now, score $200 when you see Bill Procurement in action with a demo. Just go to bill.com/procurement200. Don't wait. That's bill.com/procurement200.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I better get happy.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Keep Minute. No, this is not One Keep Minute. This is the Imprint Companion. I am Blake Howard. It is, of course, on One Heat Minute Productions. And a long time ago, way before even the end of One Heat Minute, the man that I'm talking to today and some of his creative partners, jumped into my awareness that they were finding out what happened with The Keep. They were digging into the making of The Keep, a Michael Mann film steeped in mystery and lore and alternate cuts that potentially existed in sort of like, the film got ripped away from him. There's all these like lore that had happened. And so even up until probably 2 years ago, the concept of The Keep coming to physical media was lunacy. And this person I'm talking to and their creative partners, their project, a World War II fairy tale, the making of Michael Mann's Keep, had disappeared from view. In fact, a few months ago, another company had brought out Michael Mann's The Keep on 4K. And I looked at it and I, of course, bought it. In fact, I have two copies because I'm a lunatic. And after I did that, I was like, do they have the making of documentary? No, they do not. So I went back to Twitter and my DMs and I'm scrolling through trying to find out what happened to these guys who had made a World War II fairy tale, the making of Michael Mann's The Keep. Much to my absolute shock or surprise and glee, that Imprint Films bring out this behemoth of a box set, and the pièce de résistance, the signature feature, is that the documentary is going to be in there. So I thought, well, I must try and catch up with the filmmakers behind it, who I've been in touch with for about 8 years in tiny messages back and forth. I've got the producer, Alex Kachu, here with me. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is a honor to be on your show.
And that's too much, but have you even seen this thing yet? Have you seen this ridiculous?
I've gotten my copy. It is ginormous, and it will go down in physical media history as one of the most impressive releases for a cult film.
Yeah, it is impressive.
That has ever been created.
It's impressive and excessive. I was just like, wow, this is incredible.
And well, that's what Imprint and Via Vision do, right? Like they love their films, and if one comes along, whether it be David Lynch's Dune or Neverending Story, you know, a movie that they know fans will go crazy for, they just go all out.
What's so nice is that, like, Neverending Story, we get it, right? We get it. There's a huge cult fandom. It was probably present when we were younger. You then get Dune, and you're like, well, everyone's a crazy Frank Herbert heads, there's Lynch heads, there's the new Dune kids that need to be brought up to speed. There's a great triangulation of fandoms and all those things that can go on Dune. But to see The Keep, which some people don't even know is a Michael Mann film, on this epic set. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty fantastic. And I want to say we started chatting. Like I said, my son is now 7. One Heat Minute officially concluded on his first birthday. It was a long time ago. How much of a relief is it for you and Stuart and the team that this thing is actually out there? And did I hear that you guys are going to get to screen it like in a theater somewhere?
We are exhausted. I could go into the production of it, but it's a passion project. You approach that type of project in a different way. So it wasn't like we all set out at the beginning, go, we're going to interview just 20 people or 30 people, and they're located around the globe at these places, and we'll budget travel and crews and everything else that you need for a budget. We just went out and just started doing it with money that we really didn't have. But when we would get some, when we get a paycheck, we go, oh, maybe we could go interview this guy now and this person and this person. And when it's a passion project, you just keep going. I think all told, it's definitely over 100 interviews. They're not in the final product, but they're Stuart Buck and Stefan Pator. They're obsessive. I might be a little less obsessive. I might have stopped at like 70, but they just kept going. I mean, and they're still going. I mean, even for this box set from Imprint Via Vision, it's, I know we provided the documentary. I know they provided a lot of the stills because Stefan's got an archive of just a lot of rare stuff that we handed over to Imprint to use. And at some point I was like, okay, guys, that's great. Let's just relax. And but Stuart kept cutting bonus featurettes for them, kept doing audio commentaries to add to the main disc, the 4K disc. It's a lot. And it's finally done. So it is a relief.
How did it start with you, Stuart, Stefan, your other kind of key creators? What was the genesis point? Because I think that's what interests me now as a fellow Michael Mann obsessive. It's like, what was the genesis point for you guys to go, I have to just know what the hell happened here?
It's funny. It's so long ago.
Yeah.
That it might be even hard to remember. I would say that Stefan, who's just a major collector, obsessed about movies, especially The Keep, anything that would come up for sale or anything he can get his hands on.
So cool.
Auction or online, he was just buying up, and he started his own website. I think it was in the early aughts, like maybe 2002, 2003. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they'll correct me after this, Stuart and Stefan sort of connected through the website and then started this project. And then I think a year or two went by and I jumped in because I saw a Facebook page promoting it. And I said, can I help? Because I love this movie.
And so those guys get connected at the time. And this is what I'd always wondered. So like the real Michael Mann heads know Mann and one of his key creative collaborators on The Keep, visual effects maestro, passes away. And I don't want to spoil too much of the details of the documentary because you guys obviously go in and investigate it. But the story always was that there was, because of the special effects not being able to be done and them having to cut corners and having to compromise on what was ultimately like a really radical ahead of its time vision, it was never executed in the way that it wanted to be. It was kind of messed around within the edit, which if you've ever heard of the filmmakers, the De Laurentiis brothers, that's pretty common. And Michael Mann was like, no, I don't think it worked. And for the longest time, it kind of was off. No one wanted to talk about it. And then it's only, it feels more and more as Michael Mann's kind of acclaim and recognition as like one of the true maverick American auteurs has kind of grown, that people started kind of going, oh, what about The Keep? That's a curio. That's this. And then a 35mm scan appears in secret back alley links that you get on the internet that you can download. And you don't have to watch the Danish rip that you have on a burnt DVD from 2003. And it all sort of happens. But can you remember the time? Like, was there a moment that like right then why the three of you guys were so into it then? Or was it just that this was a forgotten gem and you guys had always been on the island? And then finally, like, this electricity between all of these key creatives, yourself included, like, started going like, oh, we have to, like, find out what happened. What was that, like, genesis? Why were you guys in the trucks heading into the mountains to find out what happened in the keep?
I think it's all of the above in a way. You know, I'm a huge Michael Mann fan, and I probably became aware of him during Miami Vice. Like, yeah. I'm not even saying I hadn't even seen Thief or The Keep. It was Miami Vice and sort of being obsessed with that, and then realizing, oh, he's released Manhunter, and being like, oh, this is strange and different type of a movie, and falling in love with that, and then going back and hitting The Keep and being somewhat confounded when you first see it.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've all revisited many times and found, you know, a little bit more to it than that. You know, I think he was going for sort of dreamlike atmosphere, and I think he captured a lot of that. But yeah, I could see why people overall were just sort of confounded and didn't like the movie. But I kind of liked it. It always grew on me every time I watched it. And it was a combination that he had done this and it sort of disappeared. And I know he didn't like it. And there were all sorts of factors involved with that. But it was also because it is such a curio that you want to kind of bring it out to more people and see what they think.
Yeah, in Australia,
I was going to say, just to interrupt you, like, what do you think of The Keep?
I really, I am lucky enough that I did a video essay, like, on The Keep, which is in this gigantic box. And that was largely in part to me, after working with Imprint for so long, essentially demanding that in some way, shape or form, I could be involved, because I'm like, I have started to connect with The Keep. Like, when I first saw it, I was just like, wow, this is, like, so strange. Like, that was my original impression, was because I saw it probably last at the time in his entire filmography. I'd seen at least the first two seasons of Miami Vice. I'd gotten my hands on a copy of Thief. I'd watched Mohicans countless times, Heat bubbling on the millions at this point, you know, Insiders, all those sorts of things. And it was really early 2000s, as I was sort of the beginning of my university career, when I was looking for the stuff that I hadn't seen. So I'd seen Manhunter, like, once or twice, but that was easier to get in Australia. And then always I was looking, I was like, Jericho Mile, which I finally got a copy of, and I was like, wow, what a movie. And The Keep. And at the time that I did that, I was like, wow, what even is this thing? But to the credit of cult or weird, strange movies, you watch it and then you're like, I don't know if I like that, but I would like to watch it again. And that's been my relationship with it the entire time. I'm like, I don't know if I like that, but I want to watch it again. Now, that's early 2000s. Fast forward to 2024, 25. And I reckon it was last year that someone online had a copy of the 35mm scan of The Keep that had become available somehow, some way. And I would just say, like, I watched it a lot because, as a Michael Mann expert and lover, I'm like, I want to see what this looks like in 35mm. I'd never seen, like, a 35mm scan. I'd never seen it. And when I watched it this year, maybe it's because we've had 10 to 15 years of streaming content. Maybe we've had less interesting movies that are kind of budgeted. Maybe it's just that, like, all of these movies from the 80s and 90s look stunning, Alex. Just everything looks stunning, the way it's shot, the way it's lit, the tactile nature, everything. But I watched it again and I was like, oh, this is a huge swing and it's a failure, but a failure of a movie, like, cohesively as a whole, that takes the biggest swings of all time is always going to have my maximum level of respect. I'm like, Michael Mann went, after the success of Thief and Miami Vice, and went to make a movie where essentially he's trying to connect, like, groupthink, fascistic myth-making and like psychopathy of like John Douglas stuff that would influence him later, and make this big thing about like myth making leading to fascism. And it's cool. It's great. I love it. I don't think it's the best, but I do love watching it when it's on.
You know, when you look through, when you consider his entire sort of CV, all of his movies, it really is the odd man out in a way.
Yeah.
It's the one that's probably he's not suited for, and he jumped at anyway, because it is fantasy and it's gothic and it's horror and it's, as Mark Steenland says at one point, it's a science fiction movie set in the past. You know, it's it really is strange. But despite that, I really think that Thief and The Keep and Manhunter are sort of connected in a way visually, because I think like the visuals are there, and it's without a doubt Michael Mann. Like, oh, it's almost no. idiosyncratic. And I think that's one of the reasons I really sort of wanted to do the project, because it is so Michael Mann, but it's also the odd duckling and the, you know, the ugly duckling in the bunch. And there's something really, I don't know. I had a film teacher at one point said, if you can find one great thing about in a movie, that's part of the movie, whether it be the score or the cinematography or, you know, the script, it's something worthy to be considered. And I think even though this is now just considered a cult movie, I really do think it needs to be considered again. And I think that's why we did the project.
I really love the doc. I was so pleased to see how rigorous you were with your thesis. And I love that it was demystifying. And so really for me, so firstly, I just want to touch on, I think there is a direct connection with the visuals and the atmosphere of The Keep. We could not have Manhunter, nor his later films, particularly post Ali. You couldn't have your Collaterals and your Vices and your Public Enemies and like the manipulation of visuals and those sorts of things. You couldn't have those things if he didn't have The Keep, because The Keep was kind of like a live road test of everything that would follow. Like, I think that what he couldn't quite nail in perception and subjectivity in The Keep, like, but you see that it's there, like he's got like an idea and he's working with it, and he's just not, because of the fantasy elements and horror elements, he's not able to execute. Whereas then you take some of those same kind of stylistic visuals and you take it to Francis Dolarhyde, seeing, you know, his date be walked into a home, or seeing his date be walked into a home by a colleague, and him imagining that they're having this love affair, and then you see the lights come and you see all, it's like Manhunter and The Keep for me now are so intrinsically connected. So that's, you know, I think you're spot on. And but yeah, it's
and some filmmakers are like that, you know, they sort of are kind of, and this is a terrible thing to say, sort of learning on the job, even though Mann had so much experience. You know, he's coming from film school in Europe, so he has an art house vibe. He's also in the midst of the late 60s when all this is happening, and he's got the sort of realistic, gritty documentary going for him as well. And that's sort of some of the stuff that was sort of missing in The Keep in a way, even though he tried to apply it in the process. You know, there's a story, I don't think it's in the documentary at all, but they were shooting some of the blow up Nazi scenes with these super high speed cameras, and it took a while to set up, maybe days, because of the equipment and what was needed. And Man walked over and saw the dummy they had set up to blow up, and he said, "We can't do this. The shoes are wrong." He wouldn't have worn the shoes, and he walked away. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's someone, you know, on the crew, the camera crew, who told us that. But I think it's sort of what we know about Man. He's so exacting, and he knows what he wants in a way. And I think this is a movie where, I think he knew a lot of the elements going in of what he wanted to talk about. And I think the fantasy stuff just sort of threw him too many curveballs. And it just wasn't as focused as Mann would want on it, you know?
I was grateful for you guys doing this picture, because I had always had a gut feeling that there are some elements of in the, and I love all of them, but there's some elements in the Michael Mann fandom who are always like, the keep could be fixed. You know, there was this sort of weird thing that was emerging that, like, and I hate, you know, much love to them because they got their win, but it's like that, like, Snyder cut kind of people who were like, oh no, the keep, if they could have just done the visual effects, the movie would be great. It would be his vision. And I was like, I've always had this very healthy level of skepticism with that call of going like, well, no, he made the movie in 1983. There were limits to what you could do. The combination of elements were also probably very difficult. They're shooting in Europe. Like, how are they shooting these different things? It's like, you know, the guys who are making 2001 A Space Odyssey are making it in London, and the guys who are making Star Wars are building factory sized places with miniatures and shooting and mats, and some of the most creative people of all time are working together. So it's not impossible necessarily, but it's like they're working on a different scale. They're working on a different scope. They're working on a different, like, different levels of what is the tactile real experience versus what is actually being shot. And so I was really, like, pleased to hear, like, no, this was the movie. Like, so much of what he wanted, and he may not have been happy with how it all came together, but so much of what he wanted is there. It's just, there's certain elements that just don't work. And his experience of after the fact, like the challenges of actually finalizing the film and getting it all finished, I can totally understand why you as a young filmmaker would be like, oh, I'm not happy with that experience. So I don't want to talk about it or think about it. I want to think about those times where I was much more in control. But I feel like he goes from Thief, he has a hiccup with The Keep, and then the bounce back with Manhunter is so, so strong. It's so big. And then he almost goes, well, okay, well, I can also do period movies. And he goes and makes Mohicans, which is stunning. And you're like, oh, okay, well, he kind of can do big war-based things, period films, and he can do crime, atmospherics. Maybe they don't need to be in the same picture, you know?
I think, you know, Paramount wanted to get this movie going pretty quickly. I think Mann would have loved another 6 months to a year to prep this. You know, he's a notorious prepper. When you think of all the work he does in prep to Heat, and then he gets,
well, he did it first, Alex. He did LA Takedown. That's the best dry run through of a script of all time.
Yes, without a doubt.
It's there, like, was the no best dry... That's the first draft. It's the first draft, and then you're like, oh, okay.
No dry run for The Keep. He just read the book, changed what he wanted to make something of the use of fables, and just was rushed into this. And I think that left him unprepared, which is very unlike Mann.
Yeah.
So when people, you know, as you know, in film production, they're turning, a billion people turning to you, go, make a decision, make a decision, make a decision. When it comes to a fantasy element, without that prep, I think Mann was a little out of his, you know, out of his league in that point, which is sad. But again, it's, all of it is interesting visually and orally. I mean, the soundtrack alone is also another reason to watch the movie. But
it's almost one of those ones where there was a recent spate of them where, like, some people would release them, a special feature on a disc would just be the movie with the score playing and no dialogue. And I'm like, The Keep is kind of one of those. It is quite sparse. Like, there are chunks of, like, very, you know, deliberate dialogue and storytelling and plot, but there's so many sections where you can just watch, and you're just listening to this unbelievable score. You're watching these tense movements and piercing eyes, cigarette smoke, dark spaces, shining lights, crosses. And you're like, I could never hate this movie. I do want to say there is a great Canadian film critic named Meg Shields, who I spoke to on One Heat Minute many years ago. And we actually touched on The Keep. And she said, Blake, I almost don't want The Keep to get a physical media release because it feels like The Keep should be like a movie you find in the woods, like the video from The Ring. And when you see it, you're like, what is this? And you're like, it's Michael Mann. What's happening? Am I going to die in 7 days? And I've always loved that quote and loved her so much for that, because I think it's so amazing. But it's like, if it was going to come out and get the treatment, I think truly, with no disrespect to other companies who've also, you know, been working to get the master, working to do this. Without your whole team, Alex, you, Stuart, Safan, like without you guys and your documentary on here, it always felt incomplete. It was like the itch that always needed to be scratched.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. I wanted to go back to what you said earlier about these sort of fanboys out there on socials thinking that this could be sort of re-put together again, and that's just not what happened. No. Or what could happen. You know, we're talking the early 80s. You know, it was sort of the magical time where you're doing stuff on set practically, and you're also involving models and also involving other visual effects later on. And here comes Wally Vevers, you know, working on this movie off of, you know, movies like 2001 or Superman. You know, a guy who's been in the visual effects business in the UK since his younger days, since the 30s, with, you know, Things to Come and other films like Thief of Baghdad. So it's a little different because he was a craftsperson, you know, and there weren't like 100 visual effects companies ready to jump in and just fish, you know, do it, you know, with computer graphics. This is a guy who did it, you know, in his studios, and didn't tell too many people how to do it. You know, it's trade secrets in a way. You know, even the people working closest to him are like, we don't know what he was thinking or what he was doing or how he was doing it. But like, it's, that was your job. That was your trade. And it was very rare that you would bring on somebody and teach them the ropes, you know, unless you knew they were going to sort of replace you or help you out in your business. So
it's also like it's like a chef. It's like a great chef. There's a magic sometimes. I mean, everyone has this person in their family. You know, if you come from an ethnic background where like your nana just can make something, or your, you know, like, or your friend, like you got a friend who can just whip something together, and you literally watch them. You stand next to them and you watch the way they do something and you go, okay, I think I've got it. And you go home and you try and replicate it, and yours stinks. Like your version of their meal, it's it's not good. And you're like, I stood there, and it's timing, it's instinct, it's intuition. It's like when you're working in those arts, and that's what's so beautiful about these amazing visual effects artists and craftspeople that still use practical effects to this day. The artistry that is on show in combining those elements and making them work, there is like an instinct to it. You just have an instinct. You know, there's a great Phil Tippett with his, you know, stop motion animation stuff, like the tactile way that they look, you know, even though, and if people who are listening, you might not know who Phil Tippett is. It's like Phil Tippett was going to be the stop motion dinosaur guy for Jurassic Park before visual effects took over. But the guys who made the visual effects should thank their lucky stars, because they modeled a lot of the movement of all the dinosaurs off of models that he'd shot and structured, and their bone movements and those things. And they basically scanned them into the computers and replicated them so that they could look and feel that. And then it's all, the great thing about Jurassic Park is kind of the last great merging between old digital and physical, is they're using big rubber heads of dinosaurs and using people in suits and mixing all the elements together. And yeah, he, you know, Wally Vevers, I mean, it's his business. He wants people to see 2001: A Space Odyssey and Superman and go, who the hell did that? I want to work with that guy.
Yeah. How did they pull that off? That's the job of every visual effects guy, right? Or gal. I think when he passed, I think it definitely threw Michael Mann for a loop, and they sort of never recovered. I mean, I think as Mann was trying to come up with ideas for Wally to try, I think Wally was game and he was trying as much as he could, sort of on the fly in a way. And when Wally died, it sort of stopped that. A lot of the footage was shipped to ILM to check out. ILM was just like, they shrugged their shoulders. They're like, we don't know what this means. Well, of course you don't. The guy in his head figured out what it meant, but not you, you know? So in a way, you know, that was just one of the issues for the movie.
Yeah, it was never going to be a perfect thing. But that's what I love about this new set, is that with your doco in here and you and Stuart and Stefan and like all the stuff that is here because of your curation and because of your collective curation and finding all these interviews, this makes it definitive for me. It's like when I look at the Michael Mann sets that are out there for every film, like there are so few that feel complete, as in they have absolutely everything that I want. And the rare few that do, like, are now out of print, you know, it's like, and so like looking at this, I'm like, there is no Keep fan in the world or new potential Keep fan that could not feel like you are so deeply connected and involved and like understanding of the entire spectrum of this movie and having all these different opinions and great commentary tracks and, you know, people going through it and all the materials that you guys have curated. I feel like Imprint has really gone over and above on this. It's just like it's connected. Yeah. It's really great.
And to going back to what you said earlier, like I think we all wished we had a little bit more time to like maybe do the film festival circuit. It's a weird time to be, you know, the box set comes out, it's sort of limited edition, although I'm not sure we got a clue as to how many it's limited to. But then we are getting festival appearances and other programmers are programming in their rep theaters. So it's sort of a weird time, but also it's kind of wonderful. And I really appreciate you saying all the good words about it, because it was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and money we'll never, ever see.
I think and life experience, right? When you were talking about Stuart and Stefan going, we need to do 100 interviews. I'm like, yeah, I know exactly how that feels. I know exactly how it feels to make sure no stone is ever unturned. It's Michael Mann fans are inspired to do stuff like this.
I think if there was any chance of another physical media release separate from this on our own, not that we think there would be one, we even have even more bonus features ready for it that we just didn't include because we just ran out of time, you know.
I think we might have
like one of the last Edgar Froese's interviews, because we interviewed him after one of his concerts in Europe, and he had just had throat surgery, and you know, between that and you know, English, he spoke very good English. It was tough to listen to him.
Yeah.
And that's why we sort of avoided that, but we could definitely put it out with subtitles. And I think soon after that he passed.
Yeah. I had a very similar experience. I spoke to the great editor, Pasquale Buber, and for the show. And before we even got to live airing his episode in the sequence of the movie, he passed, which is devastating. And so, but yeah, I think that there's really something special when you can go back to these movies that mean a lot to a lot of people, even if they're a cult movie, and you can get that, capture those voices. And there's certain shows and, you know, I think, you know, I share a great deal of love for my friends who the Light the Fuse, the Mission Impossible podcast, who've gone down all those roads with all those people. It's like the curation that you guys have done and sort of work that they've done and the work I've tried to do on One Heat Minute Productions is like, it's triangulating all those key people together. And at the end of it, as you know, hopefully getting you guys in front of a few live audiences to see them react to it is my big hope. But you know, this is the set. When Imprint said they were going to do it, I was like, oh, I hope they're not just kind of refreshing what's already been out there. When they said they had your doc, I was like, now it means something. Now it's actually the big point of difference is you guys. So. Yeah,
it is the
amazing
addition to own, and they went all out. Like when I opened up the box, I mean, even I was like, wait, it's this big? I was like, holy cow. I can drop this out of a window in New York City and like kill somebody in the street down below. I mean, it's just, and then when you take out the metal cross, the front of it, and it actually weighs really heavy.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable what they've done for this. And you know what? Good for them. They're doing it to movies that people love, not just some obscure thing here and there. I mean, it certainly puts the Vinegar Syndrome one out to shame, and I love them for approaching us and saying, okay, let's see what we could do here.
There's only one missing bit, and I wish that I'd known about it earlier. Is like, I could have buried one in the woods near Meg Shields' house in Canada and sent her to a location to dig up and had that go on social media. That would have been the last pièce de résistance for me, Alex. It's just some silly thing there that the Keep truly, in so many ways, almost needs to be that found VCR that says, don't watch this. And you watch, you go home and watching, what is this? And I, but I mean, you couldn't get any more eye-catching than a giant silver reflective cross on a shelf. You know, it's pretty amazing.
I think it's going to win some awards, like as the package itself. Yeah, I mean, whoever does those awards, hopefully they're listening.
I want to go to that. Can we go, Alex? Can we? Is there an event where it's like, come touch all this cool physical media and give? I feel like I'm starting to be equipped to be a jury member on one of those things to say, like, what is really good? And this is pretty.
Look in there. It's lobby cards. It's this first draft of the script. It's the press kit. It's the comic. I mean, everything that you could think of is.
And that's even before the disc. The disc is the discs, because there are three. The discs are insane. Loaded with special features, your whole disc of the doco, like the 4K itself, it's an incredible set.
This 4K imprint got David McKenzie from Fidelity in Motion to do it.
Yeah.
And I think it just turned out great. Although some of the back alley friends where I got a number of 35 millimeter scans many years ago are still going, yeah, they still didn't nail it right. In terms of so I do have some of those skids. I occasionally will break out and go, oh yeah, maybe they did get that right. But
this is the other thing when you are really, truly physical media psycho, as Alex and I are. It's also like, I don't, if you find a pristine print and you scan it, don't touch it. I don't care. If the colors don't look great or you think the colors could be improved, I want the completely clean scan version. And I think I've really been impressed in a couple of imprint 4K releases, particularly John Schlesinger's Midnight Cowboy. The scan on that 4K is unbelievable. It's so beautiful. There is not a lick of the color that feels like it's augmented or corrected. Whereas some of the other 4Ks for even Michael Mann films, like, you know, the Heat Director's Definitive Edition, which is out and available and lots of people can buy and watch on 4K. I don't like it. It's not my favorite version of the movie. I've seen the theatrical cut, the 35 scan, too many times. I am distractedly familiar with everything that has been changed, every frame that's been cut, every modulation of the color. It's a nightmare for me.
It's one of the reasons we like Mann and we love him, because he will go in and tinker even way past the first version of the movie being done.
Yes.
And tinker some more. I mean, he's just that much of a perfectionist, and that's why he is Michael Mann. That's why we love him.
Yeah, we love him, but that's why you need sets like this, because I want all the versions. I want them all beautifully scanned on 4K. But look,
and just for the record also, I never believed there was a definitive director's cut. I know a lot of those were like, oh, it's a 3.5 hour. Where's that version? Like, it never existed. If anything, Dove Honig cut a 3.5 hour version of just the assembly, you know?
yeah.
Well, that's my belief.
So that's what I was going to say, is that's what was beautifully demystifying. It's like, no, this was kind of the movie. There might have been different effects. It might have laid better together. There might have been some other visionary things they could have done and didn't have to sort of might have been more cohesive and affecting in its way, but this is what the movie is. And I was watching your documentary and I was like, it was so nice to not have like that gotcha. Oh, there is a 4 hour cut. And if only Michael Mann could get $20 million and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, we're not doing that. It's like, this is the movie. It is what it is. And we can be grateful of people as creative people learn. You learn lessons. You change your tact. You change your approach. You pivot on a dime when you finish something. You might finish something really successfully and then put yourself into a new challenging mode. And this was like a guy who was so brave to take himself so far out of his comfort zone. And it didn't completely work, but it helped him hone his craft that the later Michael Mann that we see now as this really accomplished, specific, you know, hyper prep director can still make really fantastic movies, because he imposes this prep on his people that he works with. And then he's, you know, the one thing that's so heartening to hear, which is all the way back from your documentary, is like, I don't know when Michael sleeps. He's there at 5 a.m. and he goes home at 3. And he's, and no one understands how he even sleeps. Like,
oh, it's, I've heard from crew who worked on the Tokyo Vice pilot, and it's still the same. Like,
yeah.
Him stopping the car and going, I want to go into this dangerous neighborhood. And they're going, no, 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 no. And there he is, just jumping in. You know, he's just that guy who,
yeah.
And I think the lovely Gavin.
I want to go into this dangerous neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just, he's such a all little, the time. He's a little unassuming guy. He's just fantastic.
And, you know, Gavin McFadden, the producer on The Keep, you know, had been in Thief and gave one of the best interviews. I watched his entire interview a couple of times, and he just, you know, reiterated that. He's like, you know, man will go down, go into the most dangerous neighborhood just to find and talk to people and just see what they're about. And that's just, you know, that's sort of the documentary filmmaker that he is, sort of the person, you know, that is him. Yeah, he's relentless and he's brave. And I thank God he is, because we've gotten a number of movies that we all love. And we'll stand the test of time. I will also say this. I know Stuart and Stefan probably would have loved to have interviewed Michael Mann, and I was always against it. I was like, we can't have him in this. We can't. To, you know, from my point of view, I think it needs to be, he needs to be removed from it, because who knows, he might get involved and all of a sudden the thing changes again. We want to sort of have our own sort of freedom on this, in a way.
I think I think it's having now spoken to him and met him, I'm really glad that I spoke to him when I did with One Heat Minute, when it was finished. It was at its conclusion. There was no like speak to Michael Mann first and then change my approach to the show. It was almost like, and I think that's what's so great about your doc. It's like, you guys had an approach. You were relentless over many years with, you know, with slim resources and people who, you know, and companies with licensing and stuff who didn't want to share this stuff, but you guys were just relentless. It eventually comes here and it's amazing. And I feel like the relentless momentum of One Heat Minute was happening, and there was a runaway train, whether it ended with Michael Mann or not. And I'm so blessed and grateful that it did, because then it helped bloom into the work that I've continued to do. But I kind of agree. I was like, there was a moment in my mind where I was like, if it ends now without him, that's okay too. And I think you have to be okay with that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did it that way too. I mean, your podcast series is incredible. I have not listened to every episode. But
anyone who has, I'm like, you're amazing. Because this was clearly a man breaking down 1 minute.
Blake has lived it. So he's yeah, actually lived through every minute.
I've lived through every minute and every second and how long it takes a minute. I mean, a documentary filmmakers, I feel like, and sort of obsessive podcasters have that same thing of like, we just know how much time it takes to book every person, to carve out the time, to listen to it back, to, you know, for the most part, like, One Heat Minute didn't require a lot of like really significant editing or anything like that along the way. It wasn't that kind of show. It was more like a confessional. So people would come and we would talk, and it was about that, you know, inflaming and having that conversation. But you listen to every single interview and you listen to that, and you prepare for the next interview. And it's just like, it's relentless. It is a relentless thing to do. And the people who stayed with us for our whole journey and it meant something to them, I still to this day get lovely emails and those things, and I'm really happy, and I'm hoping the same for you guys. Those real Keep psychos out there who've been baying for blood and waiting for a release that is as towering as this, and waiting for you guys to get your chance to shine in the sun, and hopefully getting a couple of screenings out there. I'm sure it will mean a lot to them that they're like, this is the definitive thing. This makes it definitive because you guys have done all this work to do it.
Yeah, it plays the Sitges Film Festival. I don't know when this podcast is airing. It plays it the Friday, the 10th of October, around 7 p.m. We were really happy about it getting to Sitges, because if you've ever been there, it really is one of the great film fests in the world. And there's a couple others as well. I think if we get in two or three more, I think we'd be really happy. But other screenings at Rep Cinemas are starting to sort of gel as well.
There's a few big man houses that would definitely want to get you guys along, I'm sure. So there'll be some interest, I'm sure. But look, Alex, thank you so much for your time. Thanks, Stuart and Stefan, for me. I know that they were trying to make it. We were trying to triangulate our time zones across the world. It just wasn't happening. But bless them. Give them my best. Thank you so much for doing this. And it's just so cool to finally meet.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for really giving the documentary some love. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. We really appreciate it. You're welcome. You're welcome. It was important to me. And the most important thing was that you guys, you know, were relentless, and that there was no, even that there wasn't this big gotcha moment. Like, what you learn about this whole thing is just so rich. It's so amazing. It's so full. It's like, okay, this is everything you could have asked for. Cause there's no, you guys are the objective lovers and outsiders that are just scrutinizing every person. You want to dig in, you want to find if there's something else. And when there's not, it's okay. It's like this, there's not a miraculous, there's not a Donner cut. There's, you know, it's not out there. It's just, it's, this is what the movie is. And now you can see it in a way that looks better than ever before.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Imprint and Via Vision, for pulling this one off. I think it's going to go down as one of the best of the year. And we all know why man doesn't really like this movie. I think he learned a lot on it. It was more of a stepping stone for him to just jump into even greater movies. But maybe one day he'll watch it again and go, man, I wish I could have done that. How about we just try and get him to remake it?
Well, look, he's too busy with a movie that's called Heat 2 right now, and he's 80. Like, I there's only so many more. There's only so many more man movies we're going to get. And and what I would like truly is, my friends keep going to this screening, and I love them. My dear friend Katie Walsh, who was my host on Miami Nice, has just hosted a screening at Beyond Fest in LA with William Peterson ahead of Manhunter. Which personally, A, couldn't be happier. B, there is not a better film critic in the world and a more Michael Mann lover than Katie, who also loves men in particularly short shorts. So the movie and the guest star, perfect there. But they're showing a 70mm personal director's cut print in that theater that they frequently borrow from Michael Mann. And I'm like, well, now I want that on a 4K.
I've got some back alley scans. I think we came close to scanning it in 70 at one point.
Well, what's even better is now that I have Alex as a contact, we can share our back alley scans if they come about. But I want that in a set that looks like this, because I feel like, you know, for anyone who does watch it, I've done one tiny thing for this, but my connection was really Michael Mann's influence from a great German historical scholar called George Mosse, and how he leads a lot of Mann's worldview straight into John Douglas. And it's like the connections between Mosse and Douglas in this weird sort of alternate academic fields, how they connect in the same way, one on a macro level at like fascism and one at a micro level at like psychopaths. I feel like The Keep and Manhunter are, for me now, they're intrinsically connected. I can't, even though I love Manhunter, and probably that's, you know, as a movie holistically, it's probably one of my favorites of all time. I can't see them disconnected anymore.
I would even extend it to Thief as well. And yeah, it might be because Tangerine Dream's part of that soundtrack as well. But yeah, even if Tangerine Dream didn't do the Manhunter soundtrack, I think Mann was trying to get maybe Michel Rubini to kind of channel them. And he was still, you know, pulling from all this esoteric sort of out there music genres, you know, yeah. Shriekback. That's a brilliant choice. A couple of times he used them. I mean, just, that's another whole other episode that you could talk about, Mann's sort of ear.
Yeah, he's got it. What a great ear. What a great ear. And his wife, Summer, for Last of the Mohicans, giving him Promontory as the score, the foundational theme for that too. But Alex, it's been so great. Give the guys my best. Congratulations on this. Hope the audiences love it. Folks, I'm not going to recommend a random passerby buy The Keep, but if you're a Michael Mann fan and you've been wanting to get your hands on The Keep, or even if you've already bought the 4K of The Keep, it's nothing compared to this, like, literal tome of a release. It's incredible. You are literally finding it's as big as The Keep on your shelf. I don't know where I'm going to fit it in my library, but it's like, it's incredible.
Maybe Meg Shields doesn't have a copy yet. Maybe you could go into the forest.
I'm going to go dig a hole, dig a hole for Meg Shields to find it. That's, if I can't find a spot for it on my shelf, it might have to go there. After I watch every special feature, I'm just going to dig a hole, send it to Canada, ask one of our mutual friends to dig a hole next to Meg's house and send her a pinned location in a text and give her a shovel and go, this is for you to find now. It's yours.
I think it'll all come down to how much the tariffs will cost you to ship it.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure talking to you, man. It's really, I'm a big fan of what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Alex. All the best. And guys, have a great week. And we'll be back with another episode of Imprint Companion and more episodes of One Heat Minute Production Show soon.